Many people have difficulty sleeping in hospitals. Noise from noisy wards, to visits, to the loss of a person's lack of daily routine are some of the contributing factors to insomnia. A new Institute for Clinical and Evaluative Sciences study entitled Initiation of Benzodiazepines in the Elderly After Hospitalization in the July 2007 issue of the Journal of General Internal Medicine looked at prescribing sleeping pills of the benzodiazepine class, that is, medications such as lorazepam or Ativan or temazepam or Restoril, to elderly patients while they're in hospital and the consequences after discharge. I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Chaim Bell, general internist at St. Michael's Hospital, adjunct scientist at the Institute for Clinical Evaluative Sciences, and assistant professor in the Department of Medicine and Department of Health Policy Management and Evaluation at the University of Toronto. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What is the mechanism of action of benzodiazepines?
Well, benzodiazepines are drugs that can range from sort of short-acting to longer-acting medications, and they essentially work on a certain receptor in the brain. What they do is something akin to what alcohol does, and they basically decrease anxiety and can lead to drowsiness or sleepiness.
What is their specific indication for use? Granted, they're used for a lot of particular areas, but when they were first made, and when you look and you read in the CPS or the guide that tells you what these medications are designed for, what is their specific indication for use?
Well, there are certain indications. The majority of it should be for anxiety or the treatment of anxiety. There have been some things with people using it for panic attacks, I think, but the other issue is for short-term treatment of sleep disorders. And the emphasis is on the short-term.
So in general, these medications are designed to be used more short-term rather than long-term to just get people over the hump or deal with the issue at hand at that time.
Usually for episodes of insomnia, occasional sleepiness or drowsiness, non-drowsiness, or the idea that they're undergoing a procedure and that it might help relax them.
What are some of the adverse effects that are seen with these medications, in particular when we're talking about elderly patients?
These, as you point out, this can happen in anybody, but it's been found to happen more often in the elderly. Some of it might be dose-related, but a lot of it might be just any exposure at any dose. And these can range from things like residual daytime sedation, meaning that they took it the night before, but even when they wake up in the morning, they still have that sort of sleepiness or grogginess, to an effect on cognitive impairment so that it can worsen cognitive decline. And then it can also interact with balance and walking so that it would predispose to falls, including falls causing injury, as well as hip fractures and even motor vehicle collisions. Mm-hmm. And this is in particular when it's combined with other drugs or that might sedate or things like alcohol.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the introduction some of the factors that may contribute to the prescribing of these medications in hospital. How are they prescribed in hospital? And again, are there specific indications in the hospital setting that would lead physicians to prescribe for those elderly patients?
You can divide up the hospitalization into certain parts, and it depends upon the exposure of where the people are. For instance, when people are in the intensive care unit, there's very little chance for sleep. The buzzers and bells are always going off. There's always activity. So what was found is that people don't sleep properly in the intensive care unit, and that both in the ICU and even on the medical ward, any problems with sleeping might be at best treated with some of these sleeping medications. These have been cautioned to be either avoided or the doses reduced, particularly in elderly patients, but that the effects of not having sleep are be underestimated. It can predispose to all sorts of things if people are sleep deprived. So the indication for benzodiazepines in the hospital really is more of an episodic thing to treat for that short-term hospitalization.
Now, turning to your study, what was the impetus? What was it that drove you to say, I want to now look at what happens after someone is prescribed this in the hospital?
a lot of the impetus come clinical observations. And as I said before, what I do research on things that bother me. Mm-hmm. So the thing that I had seen in this situation was the problems with continuity of care, in particular continuity of care from the hospital to the community. And what I saw was something that should have been a hospital-based treatment that then became a community-based treatment. And this can happen in various means. Some of my previous work has looked at lack of continuity of care, that medications that people might have been on prior to hospitalization that should have been continued are no longer continued. In this situation, I was looking at medications that should probably not have been continued after hospitalization that then become commonplace and re-prescribed after discharge from hospital.
How did you design the study?
What we did was we tried to take patients, patients that hadn't been on benzodiazepines for a year. So in Ontario, we looked at patients over the age of 66, because in Ontario, anybody over the age of 65 has their medications covered by the province and that we have access to that database. We then looked back for all those people over the age of 66 to see whether they got a prescription for a benzodiazepine in the previous year. We did that with people that had been hospitalized, and we then observed whether or not there were new prescriptions for benzodiazepines following their hospitalization. So we followed the people who had not had prescriptions in the previous year for benzodiazepines through hospitalization, through discharge from the hospitalization, and then we looked to see if they had filled prescriptions for benzodiazepines after the hospitalization, that's in the first 7 days, and then we looked again to see whether they filled an extra prescription for benzodiazepines after within an 8 to 180 day period. So they had to fill two prescriptions for us to be called longer term users or chronic users.
And what were your results? What did you find?
So we looked at over 405,000 patient hospitalizations in this cohort. We then found that about 12,000 patients were prescribed benzodiazepines when they were discharged from hospital. And specifically, just to emphasize, these are people going back to the community, not people going to long-term care facilities. Mm-hmm. So what we found was about 3% of all patients going into the hospital who were discharged alive got a prescription and filled a prescription for a benzodiazepine. Then what we found was about 6,000 patients, so about 1.5%, or half of the patients that filled the prescription within that 7-day period, filled another prescription after their discharge from hospital. So that's what we counted as a chronic benzodiazepine mm-hmm. user. We then looked at some risk factors that were associated with an increased chance of being this chronic user. We found that patients who, actually women, had a slightly increased chance. Patients who were admitted to medical wards, that is, did not have surgery during their hospital admission. Patients that were admitted to the ICU. Patients who were admitted for a longer hospital stay, greater than 10 days, sicker patients, and patients with a prior alcoholism diagnosis were more likely to become chronic benzodiazepine users. As well, we found that young elderly were more likely to become chronic benzodiazepine users.
Well, I guess the question then is, how are these medication changes made in the hospital setting and then communicated thereafter to the family physician? Because I have experienced this, and I'm sure in your research you've encountered many physicians who experience the almost the blindsiding effect of finding out that a patient's been prescribed this medication that they filled from the hospital, and now they're coming back to see you to say, I'm on this medication, and you're sitting there going, well, why? Why are you on this?
Right, and this is symptomatic, I think, of the poor communication between the hospital and the primary care provider, which really is a focal point for something we're aiming aiming to improve, which is the continuity of care and the transitions of care. So there are a few things that are sort of the background for exactly what you said. One is communication between the hospital and the primary care provider is poor. Approximately half of all follow-up visits to the primary care provider after hospitalization do not have accompanying documentation. Mm-hmm. So that even knowing what happened during the hospitalization, is information regarding that is not available to the primary care provider for that first follow-up visit. So that's not even to say what medications were restarted, what medications were discontinued, and why. So even basic information, such as whether they were hospitalized and what happened, isn't communicated, much less more detailed and nuanced information regarding changes. So in a sense, the primary care provider, as you were saying, is left wondering what happened, giving the hospital physician the benefit of the doubt regarding certain medication changes, but a lot of it's assumption.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the focuses of what's See for Healthcare Now, which is affiliated with the Canadian Patient Safety Institute, is to try and get hospitals to really focus on medication reconciliation. And that is really looking at comparing medications that were prescribed prior to hospitalization, adjusting it for what had happened during hospitalization, and counseling patients about their new medication regimen, but as well communicating that to their primary care provider. And really that whole loop has got to be completed.
Do you see that the loop being completed by trying to incorporate the electronic records of the hospital with electronic medical records in the physician's office, or to have some means of accessing the records without having to try and call medical records at the hospital, try to prove to them that you're that patient's doctor, and being thwarted when you're told, well, privacy issues are such that we can't reveal that information to you? And that's happened on many occasions.
Yeah, it sounds like that's happened to you before.
Yes.
That's exactly what we're looking at. Now, there's been some interventions to try and get sort of automated discharge summaries, because, as I said before, it's very poor. Whether even if it's been completed, it might not actually get to the family doctor. So one of the things that you might do is to make the patient the courier, or to make sure that the family doctor is able to get to a centralized registry, not specifically to each hospital. And that's sort of the idea about a common electronic health record. But it's not only the electronic health record that could help you, mm-hmm. but it's also the idea that they have to articulate why we started things or why we stopped. And in this situation, for benzodiazepines, why you would continue a medication that really should have been for the short term is probably multifactorial. I think that there are sort of automatic order sheets where people check off boxes to say, if necessary, give the person benzodiazepine for sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is that when these people are discharged from hospital, and again, this is speculative, but it's speculation from my clinical observation. When these people are discharged from hospital, you don't necessarily review their earlier medication record. You look at the medication record that they've been given in hospital, which at various places is called the MAR, or the active medication record. And you see that they were given benzodiazepines because that was an order that was given on a PRN or as necessary basis for sleep. You then write that in the list of prescriptions, and the patient fills it. And it's assumed that they would continue it, particularly when there's an absence or a lack of medication counseling, particularly on the discharge from hospital. They're then left taking the medication or not taking the medication, and then bringing it to the family doctor for renewal. If the family doctor isn't as confident or isn't clear on the sequence of events, they might assume that there's more of an indication for this. At least that's my speculation on why this is happening.
And finally, with the short time we have left, can you give us an idea of what your next steps are? What it is that you're planning to do taking this forward?
we're trying to look at ways to attack this in the sequence of how this happens. So I've done some previous work on medication continuity in the ICU, and the idea that how medications should continue that they've been on previously, particularly the evidence-based medications. But this is something a little bit different that highlights the idea that certain medications should not be continued. So really we're trying to devise an intervention to best capture this on discharge from hospital that will communicate any changes in the medication regimen, not only discuss it or provide an opportunity to not include it on discharge home, but also to highlight it for the family doctor with some of the information that I said. The patient was on this at this dose, we changed this dose because blank, because of this mm-hmm. indication.
Right.
The patient is now on this drug for this indication. So that when you're forced to justify the prescription or the change in the prescription, then that gives you a cause to rethink the indication or rethink the prescription.
Well, Dr. Bill, I'd like to thank you very much for providing an in-depth analysis of this particular area. I think what's important, too, is that for our listeners, they're going to go through this experience either themselves or with friends or family, and it also will allow them, hopefully, to ask for that link to be there so that their doctor, their family doctor, will be able to be aware of what has happened as opposed to just dropping in and saying, well, here I am with those medications.
Absolutely. Thanks very much for your interest in my work.
Oh, it's been our pleasure.